killed abroad. And they go on to say, "We miss Shireen every moment of every day. We wake up every morning hoping that we'll finally wake up from this nightmare. We love you, Shireen."
Sherif Abdelkaddous, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Correspondent on the new documentary, The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, produced by Al Jazeera's documentary program, Fault Lines. He just won a George Polk Award for foreign television reporting. Today is the first anniversary of the death of Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah, Rose Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warner, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Once a Braided River is a documentary film by Barbara Bernstein. The film tells the story of the Willamette River before it was transformed into a Superfund site. The documentary features community groups and activists working to replace the zone and explores their vision to reclaim this stretch of river as a place where people and wildlife can thrive. Again, that's Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Senate standoff continues with a Republican boycott. Now the parties are taking the next few days to cool off. Multnomah County's leader outlines her plans for housing and education. And e-bikes are becoming more common on our roads. A PSU expert tells us why they have so much to offer. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 11th, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. As Republican state senators in Oregon boycotted any work from happening for a ninth day, Democratic leaders have now agreed to stop floor sessions in Salem through the weekend. This gives some Republicans breathing room under a new law approved by the voters that would make lawmakers who have 10 or more unexcused absences ineligible for re-election. Leaders on both sides say this gives them time to work out an agreement. Republican leaders are blocking progress on about 20 bills they object to and call hyper-partisan, including legislation on abortion, gender-affirming health care, and gun restrictions. Three senators have 9 unexcused absences as of today. In Oregon's largest county, the top elected official is the Multnomah County Chair. This week, that leader, Jessica Vega Peterson, talked about some of the most pressing issues and solutions going forward as she gave her State of the County address.
This is my very first State of the County address. It's also the first time I've ever written a speech entirely in ChatGPT, so we'll see how that goes. I am really thrilled to be hosting it in person, the first time in 3 years that it has been done in person, especially in this building, which was one of the first to be modernized by the 2012 PPS school bond, and this is what investing in our schools can do. We know that Franklin High School, like all of our schools, is filled with promise, learning, enrichment, and empowerment. And this building has already seen this community through difficult times. we have the opportunity to be in this strong school community while we're rebuilding and remaking our commitments following the COVID-19 pandemic. All of the students at Franklin have been impacted by these times, as have students and families across Multnomah County. You've worked through the difficulties of online instruction and social isolation. Many of your families have struggled. I know the impacts of these disruptions, and I appreciate your resiliency and your perseverance. And to the teachers and school administrators who've been tireless in supporting the youth and their families, I want you to know how much we see you, how much we appreciate you, and how valuable your commitment continues to be. I want to thank the Franklin student body, Principal Frazier, and your staff for helping make this happen. Thank you so very much. And I want to thank, again, the superintendent and his staff for all of the time and energy and support for Multnomah County in hosting today's events and in our many collaborations that we have as partners. I also want to thank Bobby and City Club of Portland, who has been a longtime partner of Multnomah County, for helping to host and produce this event. I appreciate you joining us again this year in a new venue, in a new format, to help bring people together, to help improve our civic discourse. And I also want to recognize and appreciate the Board of Multnomah County Commissioners who are here tonight. Thank you so much for being here. Commissioner Sharon Myron, Commissioner Sushil Jayapal, Commissioner Diane Rosenbaum, and Commissioner Lori Stegman. Thank you for joining me tonight, and thank you for all of your partnership and service to Multnomah County. I want to thank everyone in this audience who's here tonight. We have so many people from the community here. I see people who I've known from my very first days of working on the Hazelwood Neighborhood Association in East Portland who are here. I see so many young people's families from the Franklin community. I see so many employees of Multnomah County who are here tonight. So thank you for all you do, and thank you for being here tonight. I also see colleagues from other jurisdictions, representatives from community-based organizations, and members of the public who have joined us either here in person or who are watching the live stream to learn more about Multnomah County at this pivotal time. The state of the county is one of the few times the community is gathered in such a large forum to consider who we are and who we can be at this moment in our history. This follows weeks of intense work at Multnomah County to create a county budget, reviewing budget priorities, engaging community, hearing from our departments, all to create the chair's executive budget. As a board, we are now holding public briefings and connecting more deeply with the community around our specific priorities for the next fiscal year. I hope you'll consider joining us for one of our upcoming community budget hearings, taking this place virtually, in person, and in a hybrid format on May 17th and May 31st. Your voices are needed in our work and in our investments. Because as we emerge from the pandemic and into a city remade by social unrest, homelessness, economic disparity, and disconnection, we have an increasing need for a social fabric that cares for the most vulnerable. That is what Multnomah County does, cares for the most vulnerable with integrity and commitment. And that's what you do alongside us in every way that you're connected to your community and to our shared work. Through this work, I know that a more just recovery is possible and more justice is possible. Because justice starts in the ways that we connect with each other to co-create a safety net that ensures everyone has what they need to live, rise, and thrive. This is a time of transition and possibilities, with major changes in leadership across the state, the region, and Multnomah County. We meet 2023 with new learnings and opportunities resulting from changes that have taken place since the pandemic began. I see these changes as mandates to reset our priorities and our partnerships. When I ran for this office, my priorities were grounded in my strong belief in the importance of giving everyone an opportunity to succeed. A fair chance to live, rise, and thrive. This chance starts at the very beginnings of our lives, with investments in strong family connections, in an education that supports the whole person, in a community that respects and reflects who you are. In our world today, that's not always possible, but I believe it should be. A fair chance means you have the basic needs of safety, shelter, health, clean air and water, and opportunities for a fair wage and an equitable workplace. We live in a county where inequality is at the highest that it's been in decades, where gun violence has overtaken car accidents as the number one killer of young people, where life expectancy, along with birth rates, are falling. I agree with Superintendent Guerrero that we have a children and family crisis that we must work together to solve, which is one of the many reasons I am so proud of the partnership between Multnomah County and Portland Public Schools, as well as all of our school districts across the county. I know those of you living right here in the Franklin School community have dealt with these issues firsthand, including recent acts of community violence. I know this all too well myself, as the mom of teenagers living in the same house in the Hazelwood neighborhood in East Portland for almost 20 years. This community is made up of students from families across a wide area of Southeast Portland that was a part of District 3, which I served as commissioner for 6 years. And I can tell you, I love the chance representing you as county chair just as much as I did as county commissioner.
That's Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson. You are probably seeing more of them as e-bikes are becoming more popular. Many cities and states are even offering rebates, tax credits, and other incentives to buy them. I talked to Dr. Jennifer Dill with PSU. Hi, Dr. Dill. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Nice to be here with you.
So how long have you been in Portland and at PSU?
I have been both in Portland and PSU for 22 years now.
Wow, that's great. We're talking about e-bikes today with Dr. Jennifer Dill, Professor of Urban Studies and Planning and the Director of the Transportation Research and Education Center at Portland State University. Welcome. So glad to have you here, just as the weather's getting nice enough to get out there on the bikes, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I have a couple of my best friends have gotten e-bikes and just fell in love with them. I don't have one myself, but I understand that they're just wonderful devices. Describe what they are and how they differ from other modes of transportation and regular bikes.
Excellent. I'm glad you asked this question because it is important to know exactly what we're talking about. So in the U.S., most states have adopted a three-tier classification system for e-bikes. The first thing to understand is that all e-bikes have pedals that work. So you can ride the bike without electric assist if you want to. And those three classifications, two of them cap out at 20 miles an hour for the bike. So the electric assist is not going to it'll stop at 20 miles an hour. The third tops out at 28 miles an hour. And two of those classification systems are what we call electric assist or pedal assist, meaning you have to be pedaling the bike to make it move. It's not going to go just based on the electric motor. And so that's giving you that extra boost to get up hills, to start from a stop, to go just a little bit faster than you normally would. And then one of those that tops out at 20 miles an hour does have a throttle, so it will move without you pedaling, but again, topping out at 20 miles an hour. It will go faster if you can pedal faster, but the electric motor is not going to help you go faster than that.
What are you seeing in terms of trends with people buying and using e-bikes?
Well, the trends are definitely going up and up. From 2018 to 2021, the number of e-bikes sold annually in the U.S. increased from around 300,000 to over 1 million. So the trend is up, and the sales of e-bikes are rising faster than sales of standard bikes, and particularly since 2021. There is an estimate that in 2021, there were more e-bikes sold in the U.S. than electric cars and trucks. So they're definitely becoming more popular, though they still are a small fraction of all bicycles out there.
What are you seeing in terms of trends in the Portland metro area?
Our numbers are not specific to the Portland area. One thing about e-bikes, unlike cars, is they don't have to be registered. So there's no sort of government tracking of e-bikes. And so the only data that we really have comes from the manufacturers and the sales, sort of overall trends. Just anecdotally, when I'm out there, I definitely see more e-bikes on the road. And so I'm sure they're increasing at a similar rate here as to other places.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are some programs that are incentivizing people to buy them. Do you think that those are having an impact in terms of making more people want to get them?
I think they definitely are, and particularly amongst lower income households. So at Portland State, we've been tracking and keeping an inventory of types of incentive programs that are being offered to the public across the country. And right now, we've been able to find at least 70 active adopted programs in the U.S. with another 33 that are proposed and, you know, could be occurring in the future. And about a quarter of those programs are prioritizing lower income households because e-bikes are not necessarily cheap. The price, you know, of a typical e-bike will range between around $1,000 to maybe over $5,000. So that incentive can really make a difference for those households. And we are finding that they are popular when they are being offered.
When people are using these for transportation, how does it environmentally compare to the effects of a gas-powered or even electric-powered car?
There's definitely clear benefits. So we've been surveying e-bike owners. The last time, our last results are from 2017. And we found that over half of the trips that people are making on e-bikes are to places like work, errands, shopping, those types of destinations that many of us would drive our cars to go to. And we found that two-thirds of those trips, the e-bike owner said that they would have driven a car instead if they didn't have their e-bike. So we are finding that those e-bike trips are replacing car trips. We've calculated that on average, an individual e-bike owned by someone could reduce carbon emissions by around 225 kilograms per year.
And lastly, I wanted to ask you about the Transportation Research and Education Center at Portland State University, mm-hmm. where you're the director. Tell me about this center and some of the things that you're doing.
Oh, thank you for that question. So our center, we're a campus-wide center. We engage faculty and students from disciplines across campus, urban planning, civil engineering, computer science, sociology, all sorts of disciplines. And we look at all facets of transportation, everything from earthquakes and bridge construction to bicycling and e-bikes and transit and everything in between. And a lot of our work, we are engaging with the community. Some of the things that I'm most excited about is when we have our students engage with members of the community to come up with transportation solutions. We have a program called Better Block, where we work with communities to solve very small scale transportation problems in their neighborhood. So safety of kids walking to school, for example, and things like that. So I'm really excited about that engagement with the community.
Wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to touch on that I haven't asked you about?
Yes, I think we touched on it a little bit, but one of the things that continually comes up when we talk about e-bikes is that aspect of fun. And we have definitely found that in our research, that people, even compared to their regular bicycles, they say it's fun. And we have great evidence out there that, in general, people are happier when they are commuting by bicycle than other modes of transportation. And that can transfer to sort of greater well-being and mental health overall. And I think that's one of the benefits that we often don't focus on quite as much, but I think it's a good one.
All right. Sounds wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Jennifer Dill.
Thank you.
And that was Dr. Jennifer Dill, a professor of urban studies and planning and the director of the Transportation Research and Education Center at Portland State University. Millions of students in Western states are enrolled in public schools with campuses that have less than 10% tree canopy. Now there's a new public-private partnership working to plant more trees on school campuses to shade kids from extreme heat and improve their learning environment. Suzanne Potter has a story.
Last fall, on an 81-degree day, researchers measured temperatures on a California elementary school playground and found unshaded asphalt hit 107 degrees and rubber under a play structure reached 135. Now there's a growing movement to plant more trees on school campuses to provide shade. Julia Gowan with Cal Fire says the state has allocated $150 million to fund school forests and green schoolyards.
So these grants aim at removing some of that impervious surfaces to increase canopy cover, increase access to nature.
The California Schoolyard Forest System is a partnership with nonprofits Green Schoolyards America and 10 Strands, along with the California Department of Education and Cal Fire. It aims to plant enough trees to achieve 30% shade cover at the state's 8,600 K-12 schools. Sharon Danks, CEO and founder of Green Schoolyards America, says the program will prioritize schools in underserved areas because green space is not equitably distributed.
Communities that have the greatest needs economically also have the lowest tree canopy to protect their students from heat.
Andrea Yergoyan with the educational nonprofit Ten Strands says the school forests boost learning.
It puts that access right there on campus. So they don't have to have a park in their community or go on a field trip. Like, it's just right there at school. So every single day they go to a space that provides them access to the outdoors. They also have this wonderful outdoor learning laboratory.
The California Schoolyard Forest System is in the midst of publishing a free online resource library for school districts to learn best practices and choose tree species that will thrive even as the climate changes. I'm Suzanne Potter.
A patch shows promising results for kids with peanut allergies, according to a new study. Researchers from all around the world did a trial of the Viaskin peanut patch in children 1 to 3 years old who'd been diagnosed with peanut allergy. They reported in the New England Journal of Medicine their findings that 2/3 of the children tested on the patch could safely tolerate some peanut protein after 12 months. Nearly all of the participants had side effects from the patch, the most common being skin reactions like redness, itching, and swelling. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, a few clouds, a low to 52. Tomorrow's weather, mostly sunny, up to 88. An excessive heat watch will be in effect from 2 p.m. Saturday until 8 p.m. Monday. Today in history, on this date in 1934, a massive dust storm sent millions of tons of topsoil flying from the Great Plains to as far east as New York, Boston, and Atlanta. Dust storms forced thousands of families to migrate to California. Our quote of the day is from Franklin D. Roosevelt: "The nation that destroys its soil destroys itself." The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says every 15 minutes a person in the United States dies from an infection that's resistant to treatment with existing drugs. As Danielle Smith reports now, a bipartisan group of lawmakers has reintroduced the PASTURE Act,
which stands for Pioneering Antimicrobial Subscriptions to End Upsurging Resistance. The legislation would encourage investment in the development of drugs to address what some have called the antimicrobial resistance crisis. It also aims to improve the appropriate use and availability of antibiotics. David Hyun with the Pew Charitable Trust says antibiotic resistance is due to not having enough new antibiotics that have come on the market in the last couple of decades. He adds the antibiotic pipeline has been pretty dry compared with where things were about 3 or 4 decades ago.
This is a problem because our antibiotic arsenal has not been able to keep pace with the emergence of antibiotic resistance that we're seeing in patients.
Hyun emphasizes that the PASTURE Act is creating an economic incentive for the drug development pipeline to incentivize and make sure that new antibiotics are being researched and developed and filling unmet needs and space for antibiotic resistance. Professor Cornelius Clancy at the University of Pittsburgh says a key component of the bill is to establish a subscription-style model for antibiotics. He points out that the Department of Health and Human Services will pay for access to a given new drug that's active against antibiotic resistance pathogens and provide drugs to healthcare systems. Reimbursements to companies developing drugs will not be on a per-use basis for the use of the drug.
This model attempts to come up with a new way of reimbursing for antibiotics where systems will purchase access to the drugs and then they can use them as often or as little as they like, and companies are not dependent upon dose-by-dose reimbursement.
Clancy says it takes 10 to 20 years to develop a new antibiotic for the pipeline. He adds that some new antibiotics that have been introduced and gotten to clinics over the past 20 years have almost without exception, failed economically. Therefore, companies have either left or chosen not to get into the antibiotic drug development space.
And the reason that's important is we are seeing more and more resistant infections that we need new antibiotics for, and that trend is only going to increase.
Clancy emphasizes that without some sort of effort to spur antibiotic development and to improve the economic prospect for companies attempting to develop antibiotics, then the U.S. runs into the risk in the future of not having enough antibiotics against bacteria that are causing infections. I'm Danielle Smith.
For every suicide attempt that results in death, there's an estimated 6 survivors. As Catherine Carley reports, the Zero Suicide Institute is training staff at hospitals to teach the family members of people at risk how to detect and prevent suicide once a patient leaves a hospital.
Research shows nearly half of people who die by suicide interact with the healthcare system in the month before their death, providing a critical opportunity to save lives. Julie Goldstein Grummet, director of the Zero Suicide Institute at the Education Development Center, says healthcare providers will use evidence-based methods to detect suicide risk and collect real-time data as they would with other health concerns. Grummet says when interventions are used with fidelity, hospitals can reduce suicide rates of people in their care by up to 75%. She says it's always important to ask people directly if they are considering suicide and advise them to contact the nationwide Suicide and Crisis Hotline at 988. Over the next 14 months, participating hospitals will test and refine innovations to improve the care provided to patients at risk of suicide. I'm Catherine Carley.
Representative George Santos, a Republican congressman from New York, faces federal charges. A Republican delays promotions in protest of the military's abortion policy, and a new bill aims to ensure voting systems can withstand potential cyber attacks. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
I just went with it. I mean, if you're going to make up a lie, are you thinking at all? I just think it was a stupid decision in my part. Very stupid decision that I regret every day.
New York Representative George Santos laments the countless lies he told voters about his personal history during his congressional campaign, but his alleged financial crimes may haunt him the most. The freshman Republican was indicted Wednesday on 13 federal charges, including wire fraud, money laundering, theft of public funds, and lying to Congress. Santos says he is not guilty, does not plan to resign, and will seek re-election. He calls the indictment a witch hunt. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says a Republican senator's delay in approving nearly 200 military promotions over his objection to the military's abortion policy puts America at risk.
There are a number of things happening globally that indicate that we could be in a contest on any one given day.
Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama is delaying the promotions in protest of a policy approved by Austin, granting 3 weeks of paid time off and travel reimbursement for service members in need of out-of-state abortion care. Bipartisan legislation has been introduced aimed at strengthening election infrastructure. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia says voting systems would be required to undergo simulated cyber attacks as part of their standard certification process.
Maintaining the integrity of our voting systems and more importantly, the public's faith that their votes will be counted in a fair and accurate way is extraordinarily critical.
Specifically, voting systems would undergo so-called penetration testing, a practice allowing researchers to use the same techniques as cyber criminals. Voting rights advocates say outdated voting machines also lead to long lines and lost votes on Election Day. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee says the state legislature will hold a special legislative session this August focused on gun reform following last month's deadly school shooting in Nashville.
We have to stay focused on the path forward. Tennesseans are depending on us.
Lee says he will meet with lawmakers and local residents to discuss solutions to gun violence while preserving citizens' constitutional rights. Vermont's Republican governor has signed abortion and gender-affirming shield bills into law. The laws are the first in the country to explicitly include protecting access to abortion medication. The bills also protect providers for providing legally protected reproductive and gender-affirming care. I'm Catherine Carley.
Health leaders assess the pandemic's impact as the COVID emergency ends, and Bad River files an emergency motion against Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline. With these stories more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
A Lake Superior tribe wants an emergency shutdown of Enbridge's Line 5 oil and gas pipeline on its reservation. As Danielle Kading reports, that's due to fears erosion from spring flooding may compromise the line's integrity.
Attorneys for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa filed an emergency motion in federal court to shut down Line 5. The tribe's attorneys say the Bad River is less than 15 feet from the pipeline at 4 locations and only 11 feet of riverbank remains in one spot. Bad River Tribal Chair Mike Wiggins Jr. says the situation poses a tangible threat to the Bad River watershed in Lake Superior.
Enbridge is all about profit over everything, and we are about our future generations and protecting our ecosystems and downstream resources.
Enbridge spokesperson Julie Kellner says the company is extremely disappointed with the tribe's motion.
There is no change to the operating condition of Line 5. While some erosion has occurred due to the recent flooding, there is still considerable bank between the river and Line 5, and there is currently no risk to the pipeline, which continues to operate safely.
Kellner says a shutdown would have severe consequences for the U.S. and Canada. The tribe's attorneys want a federal judge to rule on its motion by Friday. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
The COVID-19 public health emergency is set to lift Thursday. Over more than 3 years of the pandemic, Native communities were hit hard. The Mountain West News Bureau's Murphy Woodhouse has more.
The numbers are astonishing. CDC data show that compared to white non-Hispanic Americans, indigenous people were 2.5 times more likely to be hospitalized and 2 times more likely to die. Over the first 2 pandemic years, Native life expectancy plummeted by 6.5 years.
Communities are going to be continuing to grapple with the consequences of this for decades to come and even generations to come.
Dr. Laura Hammond of the Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health served as the head of the Navajo Nation's COVID testing coordinating team. She said the tragic disparities are due to a number of factors, including high rates of diseases that raise the risks of COVID infections. But she also pointed to what she called the systemic racism seen in chronic underfunding and understaffing of the Indian Health Service and tribal health organizations. Despite those issues, Hammett says dedicated tribal healthcare teams have been preparing for the ending of the public health emergency, and she's optimistic that there will still be sufficient funding for free COVID vaccines and testing. I'm Murphy Woodhouse.
As the decision from 2 large tribal organizations to pull out of the Alaska Federation of Natives has begun to sink in, there's mixed reaction from Native leaders. Some have said the news caught them by surprise, but also say growing tension between competing groups at the AFN convention should have been a warning. Klinken and Haida from Southeast Alaska says it no longer needs AFN's advocacy because it's developed its own capacity to advance its causes. The Tanana Chiefs Conference, which represents villages in interior Alaska, is leaving to focus on protecting salmon and subsistence. Some longtime Native leaders have called the move a mistake. Paul Ontaguk, an Alaska historian, agrees.
About really a fifth of the population of Alaska. So if we're going to influence things, punch above our weight, we have to have a kind of unity.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 11th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971 245